is Glenn Coble, and welcome to the Progressive Life. And I will try to entertain you for the next 45 minutes. And thanks a lot, Scott, for giving me that really cold weather forecast. Makes me feel right in line with, I think I'm going to go down to North Carolina and visit my daughter down in south of Raleigh there. Yeah, it's not real warm down there either, but we will be taking off. So my show on Christmas Eve will be recorded, and it will be a playback. So don't call in that day, okay? And speaking of calling in, you're welcome to call in anytime you'd like to here at Progressive Life. And the number is 740-393-9944. Let me give you that again. 740-393-9944. You're welcome to call anytime, and we will talk to you and find out what you think about a progressive life. I'm certain I'm in the minority in this area. I just ran for election and was defeated pretty soundly, I would say. And as a progressive, I guess I should have understood that was going to happen in this area. But yeah, I'm almost finished with my biography. I've been trying to give you an idea of who I am. And I think we got up into toward the end of my DePaul career. I was assistant athletic director at DePaul in Chicago. And I had a lot of interesting things happen there. I had went to the Final Four with the DePaul team. Had world famous basketball coach Ray Meyer, who at the time was the winningest active coach in America. Now he's been surpassed, and he's passed away, as for that matter. He still holds a lot of records, or at least is in the top five in a lot of coaching records. Met a lot of great people. Being in Chicago, you tend to meet a lot of people. And as I mentioned last week, the only person that I didn't meet that I really wanted to meet was Walter Payton, and I'm sorry I missed the opportunity to meet him. I used to have a great friend I played racquetball with, now I forget his name. Anyway, he was a center for the Chicago Bulls, and Tom Borwinkle, and Tom and I played racquetball probably twice a month for maybe a year, and Tom was 7 foot. 7 foot plus, maybe, and weighed about 320 pounds, something like that. And so when you're playing racquetball against a guy like that, you don't move him. And if he hits a ball toward you, you try and get out of the way because it's going to hurt. Tom and I had a great time. Tom was one of the very early basketball players that was really shrewd about his finance. Now, this won't seem like much, but he set up a deal, and this is back in the, I think he played probably in the 70s up into the 80s, and maybe not quite into the 80s. I was there in from 78 through 83, and I think he had quit before we played racquetball. But Tom had set up a deal where he made $30,000 a year every year till the year 2000. I remember talking about that with Tom, and both of us thought, what a shrewd deal that was, and he'll be good for life. Well, I believe he's still alive. I'm not sure, but $30,000 isn't a whole lot of money anymore, and it wasn't a whole lot of money by the time 2000 rolled around. But anyway, he thought he was shrewd, and that was kind of shrewd because his career ended 20 years prior to that. So he made a lot of money for years that he was unemployed, I guess you'd call it. Tom and I had a great time. He loved shrimp, and he had enough money that after a racquetball game, he'd take me out and we'd go out and have shrimp at some great hotel or some great restaurant in Chicago. And there were some great ones. There's one right across from the Bijou restaurant or the Bijou Theater, which is where John Dillinger was shot. And it was called the Seminary. And it was a fantastic restaurant. And that's where we fed the basketball team when there were, you know, holidays or something like that, and the food service wasn't working at the university. We'd take them down there and they'd eat there. Everything legal and on the up and up. It was known by the NCAA that that's where we took them, so we were okay. But anyway, I really knew that I had arrived in sports when it was probably about 4 years into my being at DePaul. We were on television 21 times. That was part of my deal. I had to make sure that we got on TV a lot. We were on television on WGN 21 times a year. And there, at that time, I believe we only played 26 basketball games. And I got to know a lot of very interesting folks. Bryant Gumbel and his brother, Greg Gumbel. Greg and I became good friends over a kind of an embarrassing problem. We both were very short when it came to hair follicles. and yeah, I know you see him on TV, and Greg has a full head of hair. But the reason why he has a full head of hair is... Well, I'm not going to give a name out. It'll be a free plug if I do, but it's one of those hair companies that provides hair for people. And as a matter of fact, he came to me when he got fired from WBBM in Chicago. He came to me kind of crying on my shoulder and couldn't believe he had gotten fired. I couldn't believe he had either, because he was such a well-liked announcer in Chicago. And he came to me crying on my shoulder that he had been fired, and we talked for a while, and we got to be really good friends. And sure enough, after he left Chicago to go be on network television, I started getting all sorts of mailers from this company where he got his hair. And to this day, I occasionally get mailers from that same company. Several years after that fact, I met Greg at a tournament, and I said, "Did you turn my name in?" And he grinned and laughed, and he had turned my name into that company. He thought I needed a hairline. Well, anyway, I needed that company. Greg and I, anyway, we were, I knew I had really arrived, not when I got to meet Greg Gumbel, but I was standing in the lobby of a hotel that was right near the Horizon, which is where we played basketball. And there was an announce crew. It was on a Christmas, as a matter of fact. And the announce crew was Al McGuire. And Al McGuire used to be the very famous head coach of the Milwaukee... he was a very famous coach. And... Al and Dick Enberg and one other famous announcer were doing the game. And I walked into the lobby of the hotel, and there are these three very famous people, everybody kind of looking over their shoulder. Ooh, look, there's Dick Enberg. My goodness. Al yelled at me, "Hey, Coble, come on over here and sit down. Let's talk." And everybody turned around and wanted to know who Coble was. So I became famous, I guess, or at least infamous. And we had a nice talk. But I knew after I was recognized by Al McGuire and Dick Enberg that I had at least arrived on the scene. And that was kind of a heady opportunity for me. And after that, I believe we even won that game. So, you know, though, we played on Christmas Day, and that was kind of a pain because I had very young children. And So we had to stay at this hotel's penthouse, which was nice. I'm not going to complain. It had two levels and rooms for room for the parents and also a place for the kids. And we spent the night there, and that was nice, so the night, Christmas Eve. But it wasn't Christmas, you know. Christmas, you should be at home. and the kids should wake you up at 5:30 in the morning and say, Santa's come. Well, we had to do that in the lobby of this penthouse. So, but we had a good time, and the DePaul Blue Demon won that game, and so it was a very successful time. Anyway, I was there for 5 or 6 years, and we got a new athletic director, and as things happen, and I think I mentioned this last week, our athletic director was a priest, and Father Bob and I were very close, but he was required to fire us because he got fired. And so I was fortunate enough. I was in the middle of negotiating with Ohio University down in Athens, and so I took the position that they were offering and spent 13 years, I believe it was, in Athens, Ohio. Loved every minute. Well, not every minute of it, but I loved a lot of it. The problem, a lot of people say to me, wasn't it wonderful to be an athletic director? Well, first of all, I wasn't an athletic director. I was the assistant athletic director. It might have been better if I was the athletic director. They don't do quite as much as the assistants do, because as in a lot of businesses, the assistants do most of the grunt work, and that was part of my job. But as assistant there, I had a great athletic director, Harold McElhaney, who had played football for Duke, was an All-American, even had played in the Rose Bowl somehow or other. It's kind of convoluted how he got to the Rose Bowl with Duke, but he did. And if you want to look it up, I'm sure you can find out why Duke went to the Rose Bowl. We had a good program. We had a lot of good people. We were very short-staffed, but we got a lot of things done. I remember one week we were called, we called ourselves Tournament City in Athens because we held the tournament for the NCAA, and I think OSU came down and played OU that year. And we also had the women's NIT tournament there the same week. And so we called ourselves Tournament City. And what they didn't know is that my staff was made up of nothing but volunteer students, but I had a lot of them. I had about 20, 25 students that helped me out. And to this day, I still talk with several of them on Facebook. And I'm real close with probably 10 or 12 of them, and I really appreciate all the support those young people, and they're not so young anymore, but those young people gave me throughout the years. But we called ourselves Tournament City, and the reason why is because we ran those two tournaments, which, believe it or not, don't run themselves. The host staff runs them for the NIT or for the NCAA. Now, they have people there telling you what to do, but they don't do much. I measured it just because I wanted to know how many hours I was putting in. That week, I put 108 hours in. That was a long, long week, and I was never more happy than seeing the end of that week come. But we had a very good time, learned a lot of stuff. My tour of duty in Athens, Ohio, like I said, lasted 12 or 13 years and included things like, while I was there, I went and I was asked to help manage the media for the Pan American Games, which at that time were held in Indiana. Now, I was in, because I had raced sailboats when I was younger. That's a story I haven't told you about. But anyway, when I was younger, I raced on a crew that out of Michigan City, and we raced against Chicago boats. We raced Michigan City boats, Benton Harbor boats, and stuff like that. And we raced the Chicago to Mackinac race every year. And so they decided that because I knew about sailing, they'd put me in as one of the people at the sailing venue, and had a great time there, learned a lot. We had our own opening ceremony up in Michigan. It was in Michigan City, because Michigan City was right there on Lake Michigan. And that's where we held that was the boating venue. The main venue is down in Indianapolis, and had a good time. Did embarrass myself, though. I owned a little sailboat, and I had trailered it over with me, thinking, well, I get some time in sailing. And I took one of the assistants out in my sailboat and proceeded. It was way too windy for this little tiny sailboat, and proceeded to blow the stanchions out of the sailboat, and the mast fell down. So we were fortunate enough that a passing motorboat saw us and dragged us ashore. Some other things that happened while I was at OU, of course, Halloween every year. And a lot of people are afraid to talk about Halloween in Athens, especially the administration. They are terrified to talk about Halloween. They assume that the caravan of people is going to come to Athens and take over. And they kind of do take over downtown. But it's really more fun than it is dangerous. There are some incidents that do happen because there are just so many people. I think one of the years that I was there, there was 30,000 kids showed up on Halloween weekend. And that's a lot of people to find places to stay and find places to go to the bathroom. That was another problem. The administration of OU decided in their wisdom that those of us who worked for the athletic department should guard the athletic facilities. To this day, I don't know how you guard a 20,000-seat stadium made out of stone. But we had to guard that. We had to guard our baseball, softball, diamonds, and all the other fields that we had. We had to guard our swimming pool, which was locked and made out of stone. nothing ever happened that I know of, except one time when I was guarding with one of our female administrators, I was guarding the softball diamond. And we were walking around the softball time, and she thought she heard some noise. So I went over to the third base dugout, and sure enough, there's a young man and a young woman, and they were doing things that we won't talk on radio about, and we had to scare them out, and it was kind of embarrassing. But that was about the worst thing that happened. I did find a car leaking gasoline underneath the convocation center, and if that had blown up, that would have been really bad, but we got that taken care of. But usually it was just a bunch of kids being crazy and actually being way too drunk. That was a problem. The drinking was pretty intense that night, usually. But we got through it, and I enjoyed every one of the Halloweens, even though I was guarding the facilities. We continued on there, and let's see if there were some other things that were of interest. We did have several of our basketball players go on and get contracts in the NBA. One of them I can think of from Stowe, I believe it was, Dave Jamerson. He was in the first round. I think he was picked 13th or someplace like that. He was a very good basketball player that we had. As a matter of fact, I watched him set the national record of 3 points made in a single game. And I can't remember how many it was, but I think it was right around 13. Now, that record has been broken since, but it might have been. He had one game, and this might have been the game, where he scored a total of 60 or 62 points. And one of the points, he came down the court, and we were playing the University of Charleston, which was a Division II school, I believe, at the time. And we were way ahead of him. But he came down the court, and from about 35 feet out, he let one go. he launched this three-pointer, which swished through, and he just turned to the coach and he said, "I can't miss," you know. And he was just shocked himself. Well, the coach thought he was showing off and took him out with 8 minutes to go. Otherwise, he probably would have set a national record for the most three-pointers. For sure, the most three-pointers scored, but also for a high score of a game. But David was a good young man and always took things with a grain of salt and was a great basketball player. We also had, we had four or five other young men while I was there that went on to the NBA, and we had a few that went to the National Football League. We were not known, the Bulldogs were not known at the time as a great football team. As a matter of fact, I think my 12 or 13 years, we may have won 20 games the whole time. And most of those came in the first year. And in the first year, one of my first duties was to fire a football coach who, by the way, held the best record until my last year there when we got Coach Grobe, who had a pretty good season. So we went 11 years in the middle there, winning about one or two games a year, not even two, probably one and a half games a year. We were pretty bad. Anyway, next week I will try and wrap it all up, tell you what I've done here in Marion and what I haven't done and what I'd like to do. And then we'll be finished with your biographical information about myself. I did that because I knew a lot of people knew me, but I also knew a lot of people knew me from when I worked at the credit union and didn't realize all the fun things I've had the opportunity to do. So I thought I'd let you know. As the name of this show goes, The Progressive Life, A Progressive Life, I base most of my adult life as a progressive. And a lot of people wonder, what is a progressive? Well, I like to think of myself as a pragmatic progressive, and I know that's alliteration, but it's also kind of vague on what it means. But what it means is that I believe in moving forward, but I believe in moving forward with a thought to the what worked in the past and what didn't work in the past. I believe if we always are trying to go back to the past, we will do nothing but the mistakes of the past. We need to continue moving forward, and that's the only way that our society, in my belief, that's the only way our society is going to improve and get better and better. And I know a lot of people say that we aren't getting better, but in fact, I believe we are getting better, but they're in small steps. Sometimes they're so small, you don't see them. Or sometimes we take two steps back so we can take three steps forward. And again, in my opinion, that's kind of what we're doing right now, taking our steps back so that we can move forward. The progressive era was a time back at the turn of last century, not this century, but back at the 1890s through 1920 was considered the United States progressive era. And the main objectives of the progressive movement at the time were to eliminate problems that were caused by the industrialization that we had going at the time. If you recall, at that time we had Standard Oil, and we had we had a lot of major corporations that were, if not monopolies, darn close to monopolies, and they were kind of getting to the point where they could tell everybody what to do and what not to do. Does it sound familiar? I would say it does sound a little bit familiar. And one of the progressive movement's problems was to eliminate that strong monopoly movement. Also, another thing that we had concerns about at the time were urbanization. And that also is familiar right now. And we're kind of dividing our own country if you look at the election results, and look at the big board that Steve Kornacki puts up there. You will see the urban states, the East Coast, the West Coast, Chicago area, some of the Florida area. They quite often run Democratic in the major corporations where a lot of people, major towns where a lot of people live. But out in the farmlands, they run more reactionary, more conservative, and highly Republican. And we are kind of getting that problem again, where we're fighting, the urban are fighting the rural groups. And that's one of the problems that the in the early 18 or late 1890s and the 19 teens, those were problems that they had then as well. Migration. Now, does that sound familiar? That was a major problem in that time. And there were people migrating in similar to why they were migrate now is getting jobs, especially seasonal jobs. And we also had another problem that we seem to have on a perennial basis, and that's corruption in government. Now, I personally believe the corruption in our government right now is strongly attached to the amount of money you must have to run for office. Like I told you last week or the week before, I was told by the Democratic Party that I need to raise $100,000 to run for the position I was running for. I personally believe that that is obnoxious. I believe that a person with good thoughts should be the person that runs our government, not a person with big money. And that's one of the things I continue to fight for. And one of the areas that I will try to find a way to get some legislation involved in it. It won't happen in Ohio right now because Ohio has become a very conservative state with, I believe, most of the people in this area that were running as on the conservative side got about 60% of the vote, and those that were not got 30 or 40% of the vote max. There, I looked up what a conservative is as a person, conservative as defined in I believe it was a dictionary, a current dictionary. Anyway, it defined a conservative as a person who is adverse to change and holds to traditional values and attitudes, and typically in that those attitudes are typically in relationship to politics. Now, there is absolutely nothing wrong with a person who holds to traditional values and attitudes. I do too. I think we all do, and that's why I believe that we have to find a way to get around the money and get back into shaking hands with each other, because I truly believe that we all have very similar traditional values and attitudes. And I believe that if given the chance without being stirred up by those that want to get your vote without any relationship to whether they're honest or not, those people tend to not care about the typical traditional values and attitudes. They care about winning only and getting the money and the power that may come, and that's on both sides of the aisle. This same dictionary defines progressive as people who are interested in change and progress. If you're a progressive thinker, if you like to think of new ways of doing things, and you're open to change. And on the opposite side of that, there is some change that none of us want to see. And I'm not going to go into those changes, but you and I know that there are things that we don't want to change. We don't want to change the fact that most Americans are good neighbors. We don't want to change the attitude that we want America to get ahead. All of us do, whether we're conservative, progressive, reactionary. Most of us want the United States to move forward and get ahead. And that's why I really consider myself a pragmatic progressive, not just a progressive. Back in the, there was a period, I think, in the 50s where progressive was kind of thrown into the same pile with terms like communist. And my father was put on a communist watch list because he had very progressive attitudes towards race relations. And the John Birch Society called him a communist. And my father was no closer to a communist than I am. And he was a good man that just believed that all people... Well, how can you look at a little little African-American baby smile and not like that person? Or a little Japanese baby smile? Or a little Caucasian baby smile? The smiles are all the same. I've never met a kid whose mother didn't like them. I'm sure there are a few. And I know I can hear 1,000 women right now saying, there are days. I remember those days listening to my wife talking to our three children. Anyway, that's the direction that I would like us to go. I would like us to be progressive in our attitude towards each other and our attitude towards caring about each other. And I believe, Democrat or Republican, everybody likes the idea of people caring for the other person. The heated rhetoric that we get from politics is beyond the pale as far as I'm concerned. Nobody thinks quite that aggressively. And it's like going to a football game. Everybody that's at the football game, let's say it's a home game at OSU, just about everybody at that game is up in arms when the referee calls a penalty against OSU. And that's kind of the way we're getting right now with our politics. Everybody gets up in arms if one side gets an advantage over the other side and it's not your side. This movement towards your team or my team, I don't think is going to be very progressive or very helpful for the future of our American government. We need to find a way to get back to talking with each other. And some of the things that have happened recently, like the death of the last two deaths that we've had recently, Bush and names slip me sometimes. The last two Republican politicians who passed away, every discussion about those people was that they cared about the people on the other side of the aisle. We've got to get back to that situation. If we don't, we're dooming ourselves. If we become tribalistic and my team or no team, we are not going to do ourselves any favors. And I think it will come back. I think we've actually might have gotten to a point now where people are getting, on both sides of the aisle, are getting tired of hearing that type of rhetoric. And I think eventually that will change. Let me go back over a few of the things that have happened recently down at the State House. We did have to restructure the heartbeat law. And it's, I believe it's in committee right now, and they will take it back up when the new government gets put in place. The heartbeat law is the one where pregnancy has gone 6 weeks, you can no longer get an abortion. The problem with that is many people don't even know they're pregnant, at that point, You have to prove that there is a heartbeat or there isn't a heartbeat. And that will have to take up some of the doctor's time. The original heartbeat law back in 2016, the first time it went through, Governor Kasich vetoed it. And there's a lot of talk that that might happen again. But we'll find out come January or February, whenever it gets put back on the table. There also is a new bill that's related to that that is being proposed that will require high schools to teach what fetal development is and also what alternatives there are to abortion. I personally believe both of those, that bill that would do those two things is more of a religious bill than it is a government bill. And I believe that it should be seriously considered to be thrown onto the scrap pile. I understand there are people that believe strongly in those, but I don't believe that it's governmental, nor do I think it will be found as constitutional. There's also a bill, the House Bill 36, that will be going through coming in next session, requiring where it would ban the state from requiring ministers to perform marriages for persons whose religious beliefs go against their ministerial beliefs. Now, that one I kind of understand, but I thought that had always gone along. I'm absolutely certain I know that there are some churches that won't marry people if they aren't of that religion. So I really don't have any problems with that bill passing, but I really haven't read through it, so I'd like to read through that. The Stand Your Ground rule, which will also be moved into the legislature, it has all sorts of problems. There are, how do you know that the person was actually standing their ground and not just wanting to shoot somebody? How do you know that the other person had lethal weaponry that was going to shoot you? I mean, there are just a lot of problems with that. And as I mentioned last week, after they passed the lethal or the Stand Your Ground rule in Florida, gun homicide went up 21% for that first year. I'm afraid it's asking for an awful lot of problems. Another thing that I really think that we are attacking right now, that we've got to stop attacking, and I don't say we, I'm pointing the blame right now at our president. He seems to attack all journalists unless they agree with him, and that tends to be the Fox News people who tend to agree with him, but not always, and recently less and less. But I truly believe that journalism, and I was a journalist for a few years, and I'm not talking about when I broadcast football. I'm talking about I actually went out and took notes and wrote articles for newspapers. I know the rules that I had to abide by, and the rules that I had to abide by were very strict. I couldn't just say something. I had to have background proof. So if I said something, in most cases, my editor would require that I at least have corroborating evidence. It couldn't just be one person told me. It had to be two people, and they had to have some sort of honest-to-gosh proof. And I believe that we need to support our journalists. And unfortunately, we lost that young man. Yeah, I guess he wasn't so young, but Khashoggi, because government didn't like the way he was reporting. And I'm going to leave that up to you people to decide what you think about that. I don't think we should ever kill a journalist. I think that's just absolutely a force to stop social change. And we need social change or we will never move forward. We seem to be building an awful lot of walls, or wanting to build a lot of walls, against all sorts of people. And we build too many walls, but not enough. We don't build enough bridges. That's a quote from Isaac Newton. We build too many walls and not enough bridges. And I think that's very important at this current time. Isaac Newton was a shrewd man, a very well-spoken man, and I believe he was right on that particular thing. Justin Trudeau, who's the Prime Minister of Canada, once said, "You're a progressive. You should be, if you're a progressive, you really should be a feminist, because it's about equality. It's about respect. It's about making the best of the world that we have." And that really is where I lean as a progressive, making the best of the world that we have. And I would add, making the best of the world that we have for everyone, not just the rich, not just the good-looking, not just the powerful, but everyone, and give everyone a break. Tom Stoppard, he was a Czech-born British playwright. He said, "I still believe that if your aim is to change the world, journalism is a more immediate short-term weapon." And that's a good point. How much of our world gets changed every day because some reporter is sharp enough and has enough guts to go out and uncover either the wrongdoing or the right doing of different people? And I believe that that's a very important quote that I read from Tom Stoppard. You know, another gentleman that I'm going to quote, and I do a lot of quoting. I like quotes because they tend to put things more in a nutshell rather than string them all out for hours and hours. Bono said, "The less you know, the more you believe." And if you stop and think about it, if your brain is closed to intelligence, if your brain is closed to learning, if your brain is closed to creativity, thought, progressive thought, you're going to believe anybody. Anybody that throws a line that sounds right, you're going to start to believe that. "Oh, I heard that on the internet." How many people can say that? I get really tired of listening to people say, "Well, they know it's true. They a friend of theirs told them that it was true on the internet." I am one of those people that if I see something on the internet that I absolutely know is wrong, I will go fact check it, and then I will get back to the person and say, "I fact checked this," and usually I use what's the name of the fact checker that I use? I use one fact checker, and it's been pretty right on, this fact checker. And I will say that. And the people that don't want to hear it, they will tell me, "Well, that fact checker is known to be a liberal." Well, I think facts are facts, and whether it's liberal or conservative or moderate or not moderate, I believe facts are facts. Snopes is the place that I go. And I know I can hear people right now out there saying, "Oh, they're a liberal fact checker. They're always going to find what Glenn wants to hear." I don't believe that's true. I believe they do their best to give us their best. Otherwise, they wouldn't be in business very long. But make sure when you put something on the internet that you know it's a fact. And that your best friend didn't tell you that at a bar. There are an awful lot of facts that go across the bar room, the bar, from the bartender to the patron, that aren't really what one would call a fact. Well, It's about that time for me to head out of here. I've had a great morning. I appreciate you listening. I hope next week we can get a call or two, and I will give the number out better next week. I'm awful sorry, but you are listening to a program by Glenn Kobel, and I'm looking forward to talking to you next week.
Not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care in hopes that St. Nicholas would soon be there.